how people think about mental health often is initially at the crisis level. So if somebody picks me up because my wife decides I'm not as well as I usually am, mm-hmm. they're thinking the emergency level, which is our central receiving facility, our CSU, or addiction receiving. From there, if you are in crisis, you can go to any number of levels of care. You can go, you can stay in the acute care unit for a while, and then we have another component with the acute stuff, which is a little bit longer term inpatient, which is the SRT, which is about a month to as much as 6 months.
What is SRT?
Short-term residential treatment.
Okay.
I'll walk you through these
That's
so
fine.
You'll get a sense of them. But the name is not actually very telling because it's not a residential program. It's actually an inpatient program.
Okay.
Okay. And then from there, if a person has real serious mental illness, they can go to a residential program, which is not locked,
okay.
not a hospital, which is what we call our lodges.
That's what's across the street.
That's what's across the street.
Okay.
And then from there, back out into the community. So that people think of our mental health, when people think of Lakeview Center, since a lot of folks haven't been involved in services, they actually think of, well, that's where the crazy people go, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when they say crazy people, they're thinking people in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority of services we provide are not for people in crisis, as you might like any other health care.
So it's all oriented around mental health.
Correct.
You'd have the analog of the emergency room.
Correct.
Would be like your crisis, your central receiving facility. Baker Acts.
Baker Acts.
Or candidate for Baker Acts.
And yeah. Marchman Acts.
Oh, what's that?
The Marchman Act is Florida's addiction law. So drugs and alcohol. And you are a danger to yourself, danger to others, or others because of your drug use, then you can be placed onto the Marchman
Act. And that's different from the Baker Act.
That's different from the Baker Act.
How so?
Well, it's
is that something that the police decide, something that you decide?
It's whether you do a Baker Act or a Marchman Act is...
How do you spell it? M-A-R-C-H?
M-A-R-C-H-M-A-N.
Marchman. Marchman. Okay.
Is whether the view is that you... And yes, law enforcement, a professional, or family members can make the decision.
Okay.
And it really is a difference. Do you think the stuff that's going on that's a danger to them or others is really more due to drugs? In our community... And as you know, across the country, the biggest deal is fentanyl,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you've Narcan'd your mother, sister, father, brother twice, then you kind of know there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I can Marchman Act my brother
mm-hmm.
and have him involuntarily brought in, or I can do a petition to get before a judge.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was such a thing. So
yeah, it's for our community and really the country, the co-occurring stuff, and I'll walk you around.
Does that predate? Is the Marchman Act older than the Baker Act or co-terminal?
The Marchman Act and the Baker Act has evolved over the years.
Okay.
So they both have existed for a while. The Baker Act got redone in like 1971 by Maxine Baker, who was a representative back then. And it was really more of a client's rights thing
mm-hmm.
back then, because before that, mental health law was 150 years old, and most people went to the state hospital.
Mm-hmm. You got committed, and you did not have rights. And
a judge or a police officer thought that you needed to be admitted, and you were committed not to short term care,
right?
But to the state hospital system, right?
Yeah.
And so the drug laws, there were drug laws back then, but interestingly, there was an alcohol law, there was a drug law, other substance law, and then it kind of, the substance laws got combined.
Okay. Which makes sense. I mean, yeah.
And do you know who Representative Maney is?
I know the name, Judge Maney, yeah.
Judge Maney. He toured here, what was it?
A week or two,
a nice guy. Mm-hmm. He's been a county judge, as you know, for a while. He's been a big part in some of the changes in the Marchman Act and the Baker Act.
Okay.
And the biggest deal that the legislature is doing, kind of with some of our kind of suggestions, is bringing them more into alignment.
Mm.
I don't know what friends, family you've had, but most of us have had people who've either used drugs or have had stuff.
Mm.
And most folks who have psychiatric issues also use substances. So to your
question, there's overlap, right?
So to your question, how do you tell the difference?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So, okay, so there's the Central Receiving Facility for Marchman and Baker Act.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the ER or intensive care, whatever.
Emergency.
Yeah, okay. Then you have, I'm thinking hospital terms, you know, for the body, but you would have people who are, you know, needing to be inpatient serviced because they need intensive oversight. Then you would have what I think of as more of like an assisted living kind of environment for people who need not 24-hour supervision and they're not in dire need, but they do need help, and that would be like the cottages.
Yes, the one difference between an assisted living and the lodges is it's intended and designed to be therapeutic and treatment, meaning it's not where you live forever.
Oh, it's meant to be rehabilitative.
It's meant to be rehabilitative to get you out of that,
got
back
it
to the community.
As opposed to end-of-life care where it's progressive.
Where it's progressive and you just stay there the rest of your life.
And then what's the fourth one? Pure outpatient?
Well, we have outpatient, and then the phrase we use is community-based care. So I think of those as the programs where people are going, our clinicians are going out to people's homes, some are going to schools.
Case management,
mm-hmm.
right? Community-based care, and people can actually end up in any of the levels of care,
mm-hmm.
and still have the community-based care. We have, and most of the country have what are called ACT teams, which
ACT?
ACT, mm-hmm. Assertive Community Teams. Ours is called FACT, mm-hmm. Florida Assertive Community. And it really is kind of like a hospital without walls. So it's kind of like having your own psychiatrist, your own nurse, your own case manager, all wrapped into one,
mm-hmm.
for a finite group of people.
Okay.
And those people are usually the most seriously mentally ill, people with schizophrenia, people with bipolar disorder, severe depression, who need a fair amount of supervision and support.
Okay. Some of whom would live here, some of whom would be out in the community.
The majority are out in the community,
okay.
The vast majority, but every so often somebody might be in one of our residential programs.
So is Lakeview, it's a nonprofit, it's owned by a healthcare group, it's a state agency, it's purely private, like what is Lakeview? Because it used to be a subordinate to Baptist, right?
Our mother and Kelsey, our mothership is now LifeView Group.
Okay. Right? Which is a part of Baptist, or is it separate?
Part of
And that's in the last, year or two, right?
22 or 3 years.
Okay.
21, wasn't it?
I believe so.
21.
Yes. Kind of a spin-off entity,
We describe LifeView Group as a nonprofit family of companies.
Okay.
So LifeView Center, from a PR perspective, that's what I spend most of my time on as LifeView Center. But we also have Families First Network, which is child welfare.
Okay.
And GCE is Global Connections to Employment. So they're actually in 14 states. But as an example, NAS Pensacola, they do food service and custodial work. So a lot of government contracts, and the focus is jobs for people with disabilities.
Okay, so an employment arm that, since you are helping people with as much help as they need to manage their lives properly who have either addiction or mental health issues, helping them have employment would be a key part of their process, whether rehabilitative or just maintaining. And so helping them have jobs makes sense to have you involved in that, which provides these alternatives. Okay.
Correct.
You captured it quickly.
and kind of your frame of, you know, how are we like a hospital? It's, you know, we were affiliated with Baptist. When I first came to Lakeview in 95, we were not affiliated with Baptist.
Okay.
Then we became affiliated in 96. We had that relationship till 2001, which was was and is still a good relationship. But the I think where we're divergent from hospital-based systems, hospital-based systems are almost by definition point-in-time systems.
Okay.
Right? I do a service, I get you, I get. We are a continuum of care service.
Okay.
Right?
But now you're not the local continuum of care agency, right?
We're not.
That's the, opening doors, right?
That's opening doors.
Okay.
I actually happen to be the president of both. Opening doors.
Okay. I thought John Johnson was not. I thought he was. He's
so
no longer.
John Johnson was the executive director. I'm president of the board.
Okay.
Which
okay. I got you. Okay.
Yeah, so, it's a completely different. That is housing, managing of federal monies coming to a community.
Is the continuum of care.
Is a continuum.
As, like, as an entity.
As an entity. Okay. And that continuum of care includes many providers in the community, including hospitals, mental health agencies, not-for-profit.
Food banks, shelters.
Yeah, all kinds of individuals.
Okay.
I'm sure there are radio hosts who are members of the continuum of care.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's helpful. I mean, I have a much better concept of, you know, what you do, which is great. Yeah. So.
Unknown caller.
Always good.
I give my cell number out to a lot of people.
Yeah. If you need to take it, go ahead. It doesn't bother me. I'll leave if you need to.
Then they'll leave a message and I'll call back. So long as not the roofer. I just left the roofer before I came back in. But he's not. He's. I have him and I'm getting a new roof. So I was meeting with him this morning.
Lucky you.
So what? How many people are you engaged with, and at, you know, at what levels, like the four different kind of levels that you operate at?
If we do Lakeview Center, which is the mental health piece,
okay,
by itself, Lakeview Center,
not the families first, not
families
the jobs,
first,
okay,
by itself serves about 26,000 people every year.
Really?
So if you add
in Escambia only, or Santa Rosa also, or oh, Escambia to Walton.
We do.
Okay, so four county area. Like, is it carved up into the same kind of District 1, District 2, like other state things, or not quite?
Well, the services vary from county to county. Escambia and Santa Rosa have most of the services.
Okay.
Okay. In Walton County, we also have an array of services similar. In Okaloosa County, most of our services are mobile response services. You call up, you have a crisis, the clinician goes out to your house.
And okay. So no foot, no physical?
We do have an office.
We have an office.
But not a facility?
Not a facility.
No.
Okay.
No residential.
In Santa Rosa also, no facility, right? Or is there?
We have an outpatient office, but no residential.
Okay. So more convenient for people to come see you, but they don't stay there.
Yes.
Okay.
And we do a lot of telemed stuff.
Does the receiving facility handles only these two counties, or is it also Okaloosa and Walton?
The receiving facility, the central receiving facility, is Escambia and Santa Rosa counties.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I wasn't sure. Yeah. So,
however, if somebody drives from Tallahassee and has an issue in Pensacola,
and they're here, sure, that makes sense. Just like where the hospital closest to you is, where you go, right?
That's
right. So 26,000 out of a population of four counties, 700,000 or 800,000, I think, roughly something like that. I mean, that's still a lot of people.
Yeah.
We were just talking about this. I would have brought our annual report, but this year it's a year old. So I'm working on our new one, and when we were talking through it last week, it worked out to be about, so every day of the year, we have about 50 new people calling Lakeview Center, needing some sort of, and that could be crisis, that could be doctor's appointment, pharmacy, any of those things. So when you think about 50 new people coming into care every single day, that helps me wrap my head around the scope of services.
Yeah.
And our, I don't know how to say this exactly, there are also private psychiatrists and psychologists who operate in this area that are not affiliated with you, right?
Correct.
Okay,
right. But are you work through insurance, you work through Medicaid, you work through indigent care, all of the above?
All of the above.
Okay, because I think my perception has always been that Lakeview was you know, indigent care, people don't have insurance. It was a safety net system rather than, for example, the place that, you know, like if Andrew McKay had some psychiatric issue, would I call Lakeview or would I just call a doctor and say, you know, hey, I'd like to schedule an appointment. I need to do some therapy.
Well, it depends. It depends on what you got in terms of whether you call here. We have everything that the private providers have.
Okay.
Right? So if you have private insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and you want treatment, you can call us.
But they don't have the cottages or the receiving right. facility or the inpatient. They only have in-office visit, right?
Correct.
Purely outpatient, and not even probably community care either, right?
And okay. not the continuum. And recently with Homebase, which I think you've heard of.
I have. Mm-hmm. Okay. We did an interview with that recently. Yeah.
Is also, you know, specialty populations. And the big thing with Homebase is evidence-based treatment. And how do you know you're getting better?
Mm-hmm.
So the military for a long, long time has struggled with the VA and quality care,
mm-hmm.
right? And the VA is a good partner for us, but part of the home base is really that it's a disciplined, almost manualized way of doing behavioral health treatment so that you know you're doing it to, for lack of a better word, fidelity.
Okay.
Okay. And so we have a number of programs that we do like that.
Well, so I had kind of two things I wanted to do today. I didn't know if we'd be able to do both of them or not. One was just to learn what Lakeview is, which was the main reason. But I had mentioned to Sean that one of the interviews I wanted to do at some point was, what is mental health? Because as a layperson, I don't really know. And I don't feel like the different dimensions of it are very clear to me, and there's a lot of ignorance on the topic. And so that was a conversation I wanted to have, and I didn't know if you had intended to do that today or not. But
we can.
Or if you had other things in mind that we're supposed to look at things, so I don't know.
It's unless my roofer calls me, I am actually pretty good for right now.
Okay. Okay, so Dr. Joseph's... let me lay out the problem, and then you can help me understand. So we talk about homelessness, and we talk about many of the homeless having mental health issues. In my mind, that can mean anything from somebody who has psychotic breaks, schizophrenia, that could include depression, that could include alcohol or substance abuse, that could include potentially ADHD, that could include depression. I don't know if I mentioned that, but when I think about when we say people have mental health issues, it seems to encompass such a wide variety of things, some of which seem to be, you know, brain defects, some of which in other times we might have just said were personality quirks, chemical imbalances, whether natural or induced because they're taking some kind of a chemical. People have had trauma that affects them. Everything from PTSD to some genetic problem that they inherited from their parents that affects the way their brains function, like, OCD. That whole cloud of things seems to be under this one umbrella, and it seems to me like that's a terrible umbrella because it is so many different varied things with so many different kinds of treatments. Help me understand this field.
So I think the best way to understand the field is there are definitions of mental illness that are made necessary for reimbursement of services.
Okay. Well, that's very practical.
And then there are definitions...
Where there's money to treat, there will be treatment.
Right. And then there are definitions of mental illness that are more common sense.
Okay.
We all know.
Yeah.
Right? So the common sense definition and understanding of mental illness is on two levels. One is subjective. I know if I'm not doing well. Or I have a sense I'm not doing well.
In what way?
Emotionally.
Because, I mean, like, you know, my daily life, you know, my wife makes me feel bad at a moment because of something she says. I get angry or I get sad. But that's part of marriage.
But
that's normal.
That's normal.
Those are ordinary variations.
But if I say I am not, something just feels different for me. I am more angry with my wife. Mm-hmm. I am. I've thought about things like killing myself. I've never thought about that. Mm-hmm. Okay, I have just had an event, whatever the event is, a job loss, or I know subjectively. Or I feel something's different with me.
So this is qualitative and quantitative?
So that is subjective.
Difference, okay.
Okay. And then there's the objective piece, or what you might think of as objective, but it's really a third, an other person.
Okay.
So my wife looks at me and says, you're just not yourself.
Okay.
Right? And so there's common sense, there are these always has been with mental health definitions, this an other looking in, mm-hmm. and me, right? And over the years in defining mental illness or any illnesses, the objective looking in or the other looking in, you've gotten experts, right? Mm-hmm. Doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, and they say, well, here is what I'm going to define as mental illness and how we've understood mental illness.
This seems like, again, I'm a categorizer, okay,
right.
It sounds like there's one kind of category of, there's a normal me, and then there's an unwell me.
Correct.
And I feel like I'm not me, my wife feels like I'm not me. Okay, that's one kind of category. It seems like a very different kind of category that is, well, this is me, but me is unwell.
And me have maybe been unwell for a while, but I didn't know that.
Okay, sure.
Right?
Because you didn't. You've accepted the baseline. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah. I've accepted that. Doesn't everybody sleep 14 hours a day?
right.
And so that's where it then comes into what you described well as this hodgepodge. Mm-hmm. Well, what's causing me to feel that way? Mm-hmm. Right. Is it because I'm stressed? So it's an external thing. Mm-hmm. Is it because...
Dietary.
I'm eating. Is it because I like using spice? Mm-hmm. Okay, and substance induced. Or is it because I have an underlying way that my brain functions that leads me in this direction, which mm-hmm. is what... generically we've defined as a mental illness. It's a brain disorder, mm-hmm. bipolar disorder, clinical depression, schizophrenia, mm-hmm. post-traumatic stress disorder, okay, are labels. But we think of mental illness in those brain categories, and your question is really where a lot of the community kind of is. We tend to think of mental illness primarily as this pathology up here, nines and eights and tens in terms of how different we are from everybody else.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of quote-unquote mental illness, people are either not that ill or not that symptomatic.
Okay.
Okay? Most people with mental illnesses don't have things that cause them either that subjective distress or the other distress. For mm-hmm. instance... obsessive compulsive disorder is a mental illness. Mm-hmm. You want your brain surgeon to be OCD. Mm-hmm. He probably
hyper attentive to details.
He probably doesn't experience that as an issue. Mm-hmm. You probably don't experience it as an issue for him when he's doing your brain surgery. Mm-hmm. However, suppose he's planning a trip with his wife, and it takes him 2 days to get out of the house. Mm. It might be a problem there.
Okay, so things that are mental illness in some domains of your life may not be in other domains of your life, may not even be illness, maybe virtues.
Maybe virtues. And
especially if they're a byproduct of what you might call a person's normal brain function, or normal for them.
Their personality.
Right, right. I mean, you know, being... you know, my wife is very detail oriented. She was an engineer, which is great at some things, but, you know, she always has to check the lock, you know. Well, you know, I mean, and she would say, right? So how these attributes play out in different parts of your life as being normal or abnormal is part of the definition, right?
That's part of the definition. And if you think of then categories of illnesses, right?
So yeah, is that the DSM?
So people have tried to categorize, right? And so what the old DSMs used to do is they categorized illnesses based on like cutoffs. Okay,
you have thresholds this, for symptoms.
You have this, you have this, and you have this, therefore you're bipolar. But suppose you're bipolar and you're also anxious. Do you have two diagnoses? Mm-hmm. A bipolar disorder and an anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And in the old nomenclature, when I say old, 20, 30 years ago, the DSM, you would get two diagnoses. Mm-hmm. Now, the way of thinking of it is more blended for some of the reasons you said. I only got one brain. Mm-hmm. I don't have a label bipolar disorder, but I have these things that happen to me. So I do have bipolar disorder. I have up moods and down moods. I don't sleep well. Sometimes I'm up days at a time. But I'm also anxious. So I would get a bipolar, I'd get a diagnosis probably of bipolar 1 disorder with anxious distress.
Okay.
Which is more descriptive with the intent then of leading to what all treatment decisions are supposed to do. So what do I do?
Well, and it also, as a layman, over the last, say, 30 or 40 years that I've been kind of paying attention, is it seems like in the 80s, you just would have said, well, that's my weird cousin. And now you say, no, that's Cousin Larry. He's got this and this and this and this. And things that used to just be the range of human normality now get categorized as some kind of an illness or a disorder or acquire a label. And you know, for me, this business about anxiety strikes me as imaginary. Not because people don't feel anxious, but because all people feel anxious. You'd be weird if you didn't feel anxious about some things. I mean, to me, being anxious is I think about my kids when they're driving. I'm anxious. Now, it's not debilitating, but feeling anxious meeting new people is meeting new people. You know, so it seems like the various kinds of what would otherwise historically be considered normal variation among people and personalities and brain styles starts to become diagnosed because we're letting lower threshold things be considered treatable. It's sort of the every problem looks like a nail if you're a hammer. Every brain condition looks like a diagnosis if you're a psychologist.
Correct. And like with all illnesses, its thresholds matter, and this is where the subjective objective. So diabetes, right? Blood sugar kind of goes up and down. Mm-hmm. You hit a certain level, you hit a threshold. Mm-hmm. So we all have, there is normal anxiety. And if I'm okay with my normal anxiety and I'm functioning okay, I'm able to do everything I need to do. Okay, I just need to, I know when I'm meeting, okay, I'm going to go meet whoever makes me nervous, my mm-hmm. second cousin who I haven't seen. Maybe I just need to take a little time. That's normal, natural human thing.
Going through a TSA line makes everybody anxious.
Right. Taking.
It doesn't mean you need treatment.
Right.
It's the TSA line.
my niece did her, she sat for the bar. Mm-hmm. She was anxious.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Your whole future hangs on this.
It's different, though, if then the anxiety, the level of your anxiety, let's take my niece for an example, mm-hmm. was such that she got so anxious and so nervous, she had a panic attack, thought she was dying. Mm-hmm. And because she thought she was dying, she canceled taking the bar exam because she thought she was going to die. The next time she has to take the bar exam is a year down the line. Mm-hmm. You've now, is that going to worsen the anxiety the next time you have to take the bar exam,
mm-hmm.
you know? Or she's okay with not taking the bar exam. She says, I had a panic attack. I don't think I need to take it. I've been studying for this for the last 2 years. My brother says, well, Brianna,
yeah.
we spent a little bit of money on this now.
Yeah.
You really need to take the bar exam. So it's that external, well, she's not usually like that, saying, well, this is just not like, or what's causing her not to be like that. So anxiety or depression, you can't live life and not have some level of low mood,
mm-hmm.
right? That's very different than, you know, life sucks.
Mm-hmm.
It's always sucked.
I guess it
will always suck.
I guess it's kind of you know, where the boundaries are seems very shifting to me because, you know, the phrase I keep thinking of is just rub some dirt on it and go, you know, you're afraid to talk to girls in a bar. We'll do it. You know, everybody is, you know, that there's the anxiety thing in particular feels to me, layman, very much like the kind of thing where we used to just tell people suck it up and do it. And they did. And now it becomes, well, I've got anxiety. Well, by that kind of notion, maybe it's true that everybody's always been ill and didn't know it. Or maybe it's not really the kind of illness that we ought to think of that way. Maybe we just need a better cultural labels, taboos and standards that say, yeah, okay, so what?
Are the labels helpful?
Right.
Like that's what you're asking.
So yeah.
I've got three children. They're all pretty little. And a preschool teacher would tell you, we don't say that kid is bad. That kid had a bad behavior that day. We don't label that kid as bad. Is it helpful to say I have anxiety? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yeah, and which is another dimension of the question I have too, which is, you know, you can say a kid's bad. they're bad and they have room for improvement. No, but I think of ethics in this as well, that some of the things that we maybe used to would have said, or I would still say, well, that's an immoral choice.
Mm-hmm.
You need better ethics. Well, I do this because I have these mental... Well, no, you just need better ethics. You know, and what's the difference between... If everything is psychologically treatable, then where's the place in all of this for, well, no, he's a bad person.
Well, there,
you know, because certainly psychological issues can cause people to behave in what we would otherwise call immoral ways. But if it's caused because he's drug induced or schizophrenic or psychotic or, you know, whatever, these are kind of the lines that are interesting to me.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of what communities struggle with, right? Is this something that's inherent in the person's personality? They're a bad person. They do these things. And they should face the consequences or have these things happen so mm-hmm. they don't do the bad things again.
Right. How culpable are they? Right.
How
Absolutely.
Culpable are they? Or is this beyond something beyond their control,
mm-hmm.
outside of their capacity?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Probably the areas that...
which is the mens rea for legal standards, right?
Correct.
If they didn't have the evil intent because they cannot control the thing.
And so one of the things I also do is I do competency and sanity evaluations mm-hmm. in the courts, right? Mm-hmm. So people who've killed people who've done horrible, horrible things. How much of that is because they lack the capacity?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So...
So sometimes people are... They're doing crimes, let's say, as an example, because their picture of the world is so distorted that they can't do what's normal, and that's where we say that they're not culpable. They don't have the mens rea. Other people who are doing illegality, doing crimes, who know they're doing crimes, and then there's sort of a hybrid in between, which is people who might be under the influence of drugs, who have chosen to do the drugs. The drugs then cause a brain state or a chemical state or whatever where they literally can't do the right thing, don't have the kind of power over their actions that we would normally think of as culpability.
But in the state of Florida, as in most states, you that is not a reason to not hold you culpable.
Sure. Well, the drunk driver, right? Yeah. Nobody, usually the drunk driver doesn't choose the accident, but they did choose the alcohol.
So it's a function of brain capacity, I guess, for me, and I've seen over the last 30 years, you know, and I guess the perspective I have on mental illness is that if people were just aware of this continuum you talk about, it could be very, very benign to appear. And based on our biology, brain biology, based on situational events, we could stay here or we could be way up here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess the most intelligent man I ever met was a homeless guy who came in suicidal, and he was saying he also wanted to kill other people. Right? Turned out he was a college professor from the Midwest who had something happen in his family. His family lost track of him, and he wandered the country. He looked like, what was his name, the millionaire? Howard Hughes.
Okay.
And Howard Hughes was in his bearded time. Bright, bright guy. But extremely psychotic and delusional, okay? And he developed that late in his life, right, in his 50s.
And in that case, I mean, what would cause that?
Well, that's the million-dollar question.
Okay.
Right,
because I mean, if somebody starts experimenting with substances, or if they start engaging in behaviors that are sort of mild but progress, I mean, you can sort of see pathways, or I mean, I don't know, some kind of a brain disease that takes over that, you know, I mean, something akin to a Alzheimer's or a Parkinson's is going to affect you, right, but you've not had your whole life.
Yeah, the working theory, because I mean, people usually develop schizophrenia, which he was eventually diagnosed with, usually in their 18, 19, young, right? It's unusual at 40, 50 to develop a psychotic, a thought disorder like schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
But the working theory is vulnerability, right? He has had a vulnerability.
Okay.
Maybe there's some family history, although I wasn't able to find any family history. And then you add that to insults, stress insults, or it could be substance insults.
Okay. What's the word you're using? Insult.
An insult
your system.
To your system.
So trauma can be an example of that. Stress can be an example of that. Dietary change, bodily change.
And it impacts
taking the substance. Okay.
Right. And so.
Distortions to what's normal for you to handle.
Right. And your question about what is mental illness and how we diagnose mental illness, probably 15 years, maybe less than that from now, we won't be having this conversation this way. Well, what do you have to see? What behaviors do you have to notice? There'll be MRIs of where the brain lights up and where it doesn't light up, showing where you have less or more function. Frontal lobe, right? What do they say about teenage? How old are you kids?
8, 5, and 1.
Okay, so they haven't
gotten there yet.
You have teenagers?
I do. Okay. At 2018 and 2016. So okay. Yeah. So they're not there yet.
but the description of teenagers, people like to say as well. People say all teenagers are brain damaged. Why? Because they do stupid stuff.
Right. You can tell by the behavior.
You can tell. Why do they do stupid stuff?
Because they're not fully developed.
Why did we do stupid stuff? This part of the brain is not developed.
Right.
What's this part of the brain? It's your frontal lobe. It's your judgment. It's, sure, I can jump off of the building. I can do these things and I'll survive. Right? I can drive my car. I can do wheelies down now. And I'll be good. I can date 3 women at a time. I'll be good. It's judgment. That part of the brain develops over time. And so you'd be able in a number of years to just do an MRI of teenagers and see, well, are you behind where most 15-year-olds are, or are you at the 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and then hopefully it's not thought of as pathology. It's thought of as developmental. Mm-hmm. Your brain will get there. I want your brain to get there. Please don't go to jail before your brain gets there. Mm-hmm. You know, which is the way I view a lot of teenagers. And young people, actually. I think a lot of young people have the same, young adults.
So is there a, do you categorize differently on the basis of whether the illness is treated through pharmaceutical, through behavioral modification, through therapy and talk? Are those distinctions firm? Are they fluid? Is it a combination of all of those? Because, you know, when you're talking about an MRI, I could see you thinking of that as leading to, you know, perhaps pharmaceutical solutions, perhaps acupuncture solutions. I mean, who knows, right? What might work? But also through therapy, talking with somebody through these things certainly can affect your brain function, right? So
change your brain function.
Right, right. Or doing, you know, tapping or eye movement, NLP types of things. I mean, there's all kinds of possible approaches to getting the brain to be functioning better.
Right. And so we first have to then, I guess the step we first have to get for mental illness that is that these are not failings in character.
But there are failings in character.
But
does your field allow for there being still failings in character?
Which we define as personality disorders, diagnostically.
Okay.
But and they're not mutually exclusive. I can be a jerk and still have schizophrenia.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Well, I guess, you know, I mean, a person might have a mental illness that makes them a kleptomaniac, I suppose. I mean, you're looking like that doesn't make sense, but okay.
You could be obsessive compulsive for stealing.
Okay.
I guess.
But you also, you also have people who just choose to steal.
Yeah, people who choose to steal.
And I'm always worried that the mental health concept starts to reduce the place of concepts like morality and choice and pushes them away instead of thinking that people need to be, you know, therapized or...
Yeah, and I think that is a real thing in most cultures, you know, is... but I think it comes back to capacity and ability to change that capacity. And to your question of, well, what are the interventions, right? The good thing about kids, right, is their brains are young. Mm-hmm. And so the capacity is greater for change.
And parents are intervening constantly.
Right.
Shaping that future out of what we have right now.
However, how you intervene with that kid to get the end result will depend on that kid. Mm-hmm. If you have a very strong-willed kid and you say, I need you to take Adderall, I need you to take this, I ain't taking that. F you. Or they say, well, Mom, Dad, can I just talk to somebody in the meantime? That's what I want to try first. The whole thing would...
And on that note, especially with kids, what we have here is, you know, a need for better parenting, not a need for some better pharmaceutical. Or what you need is a pharmaceutical and not better parenting. You know, there can be both mistakes, right? That's part of what concerns me in this field, too, is...
Yeah, well, it concerns me also, and it is one of those, you know, again, I've done this for a while, and one of the things I think we do a disservice as mental health folks sometimes is make people feel stupid, right? Yeah, that, and we particularly with young people, teenagers, kids, you're a crazy kid, you're a bad kid, or I'm going to put you on a pill. No, medications are helpful and they do work in instances, but the most important intervention strategy that makes a difference is a simple thing, which is you meet people where they're at. If you're trying to change stuff with a 15-year-old who's strong-willed, you can overpower them and get them to do what you want to do. You will win the war and you lose the battle. Mm-hmm. I am not a great advocate for, you know, lots of kids, and it's a, you know, I've worked with a lot of parents and talked to mothers and fathers around this. A child who is depressed, she's being bullied at school, and they're calling her names, and she feels like she's kicked out of her group or clique, mm-hmm. right? And she says, I don't know why I should live, Mom. I did think about killing myself.
That reaction to massive social loss, in some ways, is almost a healthy one. That decision to try to do that, that's not a healthy decision, but the great pain right. that somebody feels from being bullied by former friends, being ostracized from their social network, losing those relationships, that's supposed to hurt like hell. Oh God, what do I do? That's not evidence of a problem. That's evidence of a healthy person. Then what do you do with it, right?
Then that's the thing. What do you do with it? Suppose the parent then says, you're making this all up, mm-hmm. right? You're a straight A student. You're better than these people. Mm-hmm. Pull up your socks and go back to school.
Right.
That's one reaction.
And with some kids, that might work.
And some kids, that might work. Or
you're right.
You could have the other parent says, no kid of mine's going to kill themselves. Mm-hmm. And, I've heard this before. People kill themselves all. I'm going to Baker Act you. I'm taking you to the hospital now. Mm-hmm. And actually, people kind of are often in between those two.
Sure.
Right? But both have problems, right? Mm-hmm. So I take that child to the hospital. I've just now reached out for help to my parent. And I'm going to the hospital. I'm labeled a crazy kid mm-hmm. when I go back to school. Mm-hmm. Has that helped me? Mm-hmm. So this is why I'm glad you do the stuff that you do. Because, we influence, or I influence, when people come in and ask for help. The mm-hmm. organization influences. Clinicians influence. And I say, Mom, Dad, let me think about this with you. Here's some options. My preference is we don't put her in the hospital right now. She reached out to you. You have knives, guns. Has she ever said she's going to do it? No, she never said anything like that. Here's what I think. We need to take it seriously. I think she's got all kinds of capacity. How about she come in and just talk to somebody and maybe with you for the mm-hmm. next couple of weeks? Not going to be a long-term thing. And that's the therapeutic intervention. The catch-22 for what you're asking is, do they have an illness? Mm-hmm. For Lakeview Center to treat that child, what does Lakeview Center have to say?
What was your original answer? You need to have a funding source, and a funding source needs a diagnosable illness, right?
And what would that illness be?
Yeah.
It'd be depression.
Yeah.
Right? Or it could be an adjustment disorder, an adjustment to these life circumstances. Mm-hmm. But you would have a diagnosis in a mental health system, but it's not necessarily a pathology.
Right? When you say a pathology, you mean?
Meaning bad.
It's a defect.
A defect, something's okay. wrong with you. And in this child's case also, it may not have gotten to any threshold of when we're talking about brain issues. Mm-hmm. Maybe her brain's completely normal.
Reacting to this social trauma, right.
You get this intervention, she goes on and she becomes the next whatever.
And I am assuming, I'd be surprised to be wrong about this, but I'm assuming that for a lot of parents, they'd feel like coming to get professional help is a last resort, is a brink of failure kind of resort, or it's not so serious that yet, and so that they feel that way.
They feel that way. And
I'm going to try my ways first, and we're going to see how long this takes, and we're going to see if she gets over it. And if it lasts long enough or becomes serious enough kind of thing.
Well, yeah, and I guess in fairness to parents and to people that I've talked to, is parents, like anybody else, and communities have different skills and capacities. There are some parents who are better therapists than the therapists.
Right, and some that are much worse.
And there are some that are much worse.
Right.
So those parents who possess that skill, and some of it is just being a parent. Mm-hmm. Most parents, I believe, are probably sevens. Mm-hmm. Okay, we could all kind of go up to it. But most are sevens.
A little training, we could be better.
We could all be better, right? But they have some that are twos.
Yeah.
Right?
We still have some that are negative fives, you know?
And you have some that are nine and
right,
ten.
Exactly, right.
Those nine and ten parents are not going to take those kids anywhere because they've had that conversation, or they talk to their minister, they take them to the minister.
Yeah.
Problem's resolved. You don't need to come into a behavior, you know, and but that parent says, "Well, I just don't know what to do." Or what we see most often is the family systems are dysfunctional. There is not a parent in the system to just make that decision. Or there are other stresses that family system. So, and then when we get them is because, well, we have foster care, children in foster care. Mm-hmm. So they've been, the parents, they've lost custody because they were using drugs or they had mental illness. That kid has that very same kind of thing happening. Mm-hmm. In foster care, his or her options and capacity to kind of just bounce back
right
is very, very different, right?
Right.
And so I guess the difficulty and the frustration for me over the years has been, how do we not judge children? How do we not judge people? Kind of meet them where they're at. There are some things that are obvious. I think God's talking to me. Don't you hear him talking to me? I'm a genius, you know. There are some things that are obvious. I think God's talking to me. Don't you hear him talking to me? I'm a genius, you know. It's clear that something's going on.
Well, okay, so that's to me, that's another case I was kind of curious about. I communicate with God. I hear God. Not audible voice type stuff, but, you know, what we would, as Christians, we would say, my spirit, or I feel like clear communication. There's the perception of clinical disciplines by religious people is that you all think that makes us crazy. How do you assess something like that? Because there are clearly people who, they're not hearing from God, you know. Not because God doesn't talk, but because the things you're doing are not things that are, you know, in any way consistent with who that being is.
Yeah. So
clearly people have hallucinations and voices that are not.
Yeah. So that's a picture my mother drew, right?
Okay.
My mother I was brought up Roman Catholic. That's the crucified Jesus / Bob Marley.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought it was Bob Marley at first, and then you said that it was Jesus and your mom, and I'm thinking, okay, it's a kind of, for people who can't see, it's kind of a, it's an abstract, almost if Dolly was doing charcoal in a couple of colors.
She loves Dolly, by the
way. Oh, okay. See, that makes sense.
and so I grew up very spiritual, and my mother believes very deeply that... that there are reasons for things.
Sure.
For faith, right? And so I think the difference is, again, not to judge that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When I say somebody is talking to you, it is, or God's talking to you, I as a professional have made a decision based on what you're saying to me that it's an internal stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
You're hearing something that is not there. So I'm asking, well, is it God talking to you? Like, you know, I pray a lot and I sometimes feel God is with me. and I listen to God, and God directs my life. Is that what you're telling me? Oh, no, no, you're not like me. He and I are special. He doesn't talk to you like he talks to me. Aren't you hearing him now? He's telling me you need to shut up. And then if you do that with God, also ever so often tells me that I'm the only chosen one and I need to kill the ones that are not chosen. All right? No. We, Lakeview Center, is one of the few organizations, and we might be the only one, actually, who has on staff a full-time chaplain, Chaplain Dan. I don't know, we might walk by and see him. It is not unusual for somebody who truly has psychosis, quote-unquote, are hearing things, those things they believe is God, or they believe... And they are saying, I don't need medications. God will heal me. Okay, some of them have been in our residential program. And what Chaplain Dan has helped us with is that it is, again, the whole issue is we want to win the war, not the battle. Right? Are they hurting themselves? No. And it wouldn't be the person saying, I'm going to kill somebody.
Right.
They are delusional. We do think they have a mental illness. They're, for right now, not taking their medications, but they're okay in the residential program. We're not going to put them in a hospital. Chaplain Dan has, with a number of these folks, that said, Dan, why don't you talk to them? See if you can help them make some inroads between their belief, which you don't want to take away, right?
Well, that's, and that's, I guess, part of what I was asking is, Is there room in your profession for a person like Andrew McKay, who says, I think on most of your basic metrics, I'd score pretty normal. You know, I don't feel like I have any mental illness. But I definitely communicate with God, and he definitely communicates with me. He's not talking right now. You know, it's not like that. But, you know... Clear guidance at times, clarity of communication at times, things that I absolutely do not believe originate from just within me as a imagining or a dream or a self-created, you know, something like that. Does that automatically produce in you the thinking that I need a diagnosis, or does that produce in you the possibility that God, or, you know, theoretically a demon, is really communicating with me something outside of my, you know, supernatural things?
Yeah.
Where does that fit in your scheme?
Well, I think where it ought to fit in a, whether it's my scheme, but any reasonable behavioral health or mental health professional is that you don't have a mental illness. Those things are completely normal and are inappropriate. Which is where my mother would be. Okay,
The artist.
but again, I think this is where mental health professionals, we've often done a disservice. We haven't kind of communicated. Yeah, it's clear that that's not a mental illness. It's clear there's no, there's actually reasonably no strife. Right? And at least for what I have seen, that's curative for a lot of our folks is, yeah, you get the medications. Yes, you have healthier environments. But why do you live? What's important for you? What's your purpose? Okay. Now, Dan will say that's spirituality. It's not a religion, right? It's what you live for, and it varies. So that sense of purpose and some of that connection is one of the things as therapy progresses is you hope people get to. I'd like to say sometimes, well, I wish I could just marry off everybody that they could meet somebody who mm-hmm. kind of attaches to them,
mm-hmm.
right? So, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little unhappy with where it seemed to be going, but then it came to a better, you know, you're looking for things that are, either a person wants to change because they feel like something is going horribly wrong, or there really is something going horribly wrong, and kind of whatever their world-making process, skill, picture is, if it's not producing disorder behavior or anxiety, strife, then you're not trying to fix what isn't broken, is what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
So
spirituality is good for your mental health, I think.
Yeah, and what's normal is so broad.
Oh, right, right, absolutely.
Right? And there's social context to normal, right?
Within cultures, within times,
cultures,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, there was a time in this book homosexuality was defined as a pathology,
mm-hmm.
right? And it had treatments,
mm-hmm.
right? So cultural norms change, and the science change. I guess the biggest challenge for mental health professionals like me and the rest of us is, are we open to change? Are we open to evidence? Are we open to not always being the quote-unquote expert?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I guess the way I viewed it and why I kind of, and I think has been the truth for why I've been with Lakeview Center for so many years, is allowing people's, what I think is, almost natural capacity for healing. Right? If you just give people half a chance, I think most people can get there.
Mm.
Right? It's this concept of resiliency and capacity to bounce back.
My dad is a pastor and a counselor, and he's often kind of said that too, is, people have incredible capacity. Sometimes they just need a few tools.
Right.
You know, sometimes they need a lot of tools. But sometimes they just need a few tools, and it's amazing what they can do if they learn the tools.
Yeah.
So, well, this has been super interesting to me, you know. So I have no idea what I'm going to do with this on my radio show. But I think I may just kind of play it over the course of days.
Oh, sure.
Because it's, I can't do it on a single day time-wise, but it's interesting. And it really, we didn't answer the first question I have, but I still feel like we made progress.
Which is the first question?
That one about what is mental illness? It's all these different things. It's all these different, you know, it's anxiety, it's ADHD, it's psychosis, it's post-traumatic stress. It's so many different things. And so when we say, what I often hear, for example, in talking about homeless people is, well, it's so bound up with mental illness. And it clearly is. But I feel like that's almost an excuse without content. It's something we say because we kind of want to, you know, like Nietzsche would say, you know, you put a label on, you've controlled it, right? Well, if you can call it mental illness, you feel like you've gotten some kind of control, but that can mean so much that it's not really helpful necessarily.
Yeah, and I guess if you use the homeless population, there are a lot of people who are homeless who have had issues with mental illness,
mm-hmm.
And are diagnosed with illnesses like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. There are a lot who don't.
Mm-hmm.
The nature of being homeless in itself has its own stressors, just like the nature of being put in jail or prison.
Right, right.
Which causes behaviors which, at least in my opinion, are kind of, like you said, completely different. I've met people who are on the streets who've kind of come in and they've gotten off of drugs and taken psych meds. And some of the things that are done when you're in certain environments are adaptive in those environments, but maladaptive in our everyday life.
Of course, right.
An example is prison.
Mm-hmm.
In prison, you don't want to get beat up or stabbed,
mm-hmm.
so you'll be a jerk. If you do that, then you're
right.
It's a problem. So you come from that to this.
Well, think of, I mean, people who grow up in highly dysfunctional families, and then, I mean, what you do to survive, and then if you do that when you're around less dysfunctional people, is very dangerous, counterproductive, right? But, you know, if that's
Yeah, and so that large question you have around what is mental illness is why it's probably not clear is because there are real definitions. There are federal definitions. Mm-hmm. There are state definitions. There are definitions in the Diagnostic and Statistical
More than just manual, a couple.
Right? But it then boils down to, well, so what? To your point. Well, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
If we're all about doing something, well, okay, you think they have a mental illness, you think, well, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my view is that it's for all of us to kind of, I'm glad you're grappling with this. I wish more people were, because we all have a part. Certainly everybody who's a parent has a part.
Right.
Everybody who influences other people.
Friend, a coworker, we are all in society. Right. And even if we weren't, we all have ourselves.
Right.
No, I agree. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
You were taking all these notes. Made me so uncomfortable.
helps me pay attention.
Yeah, no, I know. We actually talked about that the other day.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk, Andrew. I am.